It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Governor Tony Evers and Foxconn Chairman Terry Goh met for the first time yesterday. We'll find out what we know about that meeting and what it means for the future of the Foxconn project. First, do you have a drawer in your kitchen that's full of culinary gadgets and tools? Some you actually use, others you haven't touched in years, except to get them out of the way of the other stuff that you need. The folks at America's Test Kitchen put these items through their paces to determine which ones are worth the investment and which ones are more trouble than they're worth. Remember the slap chop?
Now look, here's a potato. One slap, you got big chunks for stews. Two slaps, home fries in a second. And look at this. But you add a mushroom, the more you do it, the finer it gets. You don't have to switch any blades.
Big fans of the Slap Chop commercial here, anyway. In this week's edition of Food Friday, we're going to find out which tools we should definitely have in our kitchens, which ones are nice but not necessarily essential, and which ones we should just leave alone. Hannah Crowley is the executive editor of Tastings and Testings at America's Test Kitchen. Hannah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, Hannah, I imagine there's a gadget for pretty much everything, but it's easy to go over the top, right? We don't need all the stuff that's out there.
No, you definitely don't need everything.
So how many gadgets would you say have been tested over the years by America's Test Kitchen?
Oh, my gosh. 1,000, maybe, somewhere around there.
Now, what is your favorite tool, the thing you use and maybe cherish more than any other in the kitchen?
Oh, gosh, that's like asking me to pick a favorite child.
Yeah, we'll ask you that next.
I have a very close relationship with my Dutch oven, so a big cast iron pot. You can just do so many things in them that even though it weighs like 15 pounds, I still lug it out almost every day.
Yeah, what are some of the things you use that for on a regular basis?
Well, because it's got that thick cast iron design. You can sear anything in it. It retains heat really well. You can deep fry in it. I'm a big fan of deep fried food. And then you can do soups and stews and pastas. And usually, I don't know if you've seen one of these, they're usually enameled on all bright colors, or they're cast iron. So they're good looking. So you can also put them right on the table, which is great.
And you talk about making soups and sauteing stuff in them. And that's a problem I have if I have a less thick soup pot. It'll get really hot in one place and burn the onions over here and not cook them on the other side. It's really uneven. The thing about the Dutch oven, right, is that it heats evenly. So you're really cooking everything evenly. Or that's the experience I've had anyway. Is that what you get?
Yeah, definitely. Evenly and slower, too. I don't know about you, but for better or for worse, I'm often multitasking when I'm cooking. So if you have a thinner pot, you turn around to do something else, and then your onions are burnt.
So big picture, what do you think is the biggest mistake people make when it comes to deciding whether or not they need a new kitchen gizmo of some sort?
I would say take a close, deep look inside your soul and decide if you're really going to use it. You know, you might see like a trendy new item like an air fryer or a instant pot / multi-cooker device, and it may seem really cool, but you need to think about yourself, not just like, is it a cool idea? Think about like, will I actually use this in my life?
Now, you're with America's Test Kitchen. I'm guessing you're pretty savvy, but is there something you've ever bought that you're like a couple years later, like, why? Why did I get that again?
Oh, my gosh. So many things. I would say, so I got married like 6 or 7 years ago, and I registered completely wrong. I registered for the person I think I wanted to be, or I thought I should be. I registered for everything for baking, everything for this, everything for that, all these things that I thought a kitchen should have, but not what I needed and what I would actually use in my kitchen. And guess where all that stuff is right now?
in my basement. We're talking to Hannah Crowley from America's Test Kitchen about kitchen gadgets and tools, what we need, what we want, what we can do without. And Hannah, you whipped up a list for us, and this is fantastic. Gadgets that you highly recommend, ones that are decent to have, ones we can steer clear of. If anybody, by the way, is about to register for kitchen goods, say if you're getting married, this would be a lovely list to have. WPR.org/Food Friday is where you can find that. You've got a lot of the basics there, and you say one of them, a good 8-inch chef's knife. I want to key in on that good word. How do we pick out a good basic chef's knife?
It's all about how it feels in your hand. You definitely want to make sure, well, I shouldn't say make sure. Every so much of ordering is online now. But you want to think about the handle. We look at something called affordability, which means we like big, comfortable, grippy handles that afford you a couple different ways to hold them. Sometimes handles have weird rivets or ridges that can be painful with repetitive motion, which is really what cutting is. And then sharpness. This is the thing. You want to make sure we tend to like 15-degree edges, which means they're sharpened to 15 degrees on either side. This is a little bit narrower than the classic German knives, which were typically 20 degrees on either side. So I would look for a 15-degree knife. We like the Victorinox Fibrox 8-inch chef's knife. It's like $40, I think. So it's really reasonable, and it's a great all-around knife.
I got, speaking of weddings, a knife set when we got married, and I've got to say probably 70% of my knifeage has been with the chef's knife. That was the key part of that. Are there other key knives that we want to have around for sure?
Yeah, so we say the top three are chef's knife, a paring knife, and a bread knife. And the reason we say a paring knife and a bread knife, paring knife is that short blade is really good for detail work when you need to get in real close and the chef's knife is just too long. And a bread knife is really good because it's got that serrated edge, so you can really get down into crusty things. So those three are the top. And then from there, you can expand out into, depending on your interests. You know, if you eat a lot of meat, maybe a cleaver or a boning knife. If you're into veggies, maybe a vegetable cleaver. If you do a lot of big roasts, maybe a slicing knife. Knives are really fun.
And then let's move on to something less pointy, a whisk. And is there a particular kind of whisk? I feel like I've had good and bad whisks, like ones that you try to stir, I don't know, pancake batter, and they kind of smoosh up and don't accomplish anything for you. And I've had better ones. How do we pick out a good whisk?
Yeah, we like what they're called slim whisks. You know, some of them are balloon whisks. They're just too big.
Yeah.
And another thing we look at is balance. So I don't know if you've ever had this. Like you have a whisk sitting in the bowl and then it flips over backwards and flings your batter everywhere. So
you know,
we like.
I have had that.
Handles.
And I feel like the guy in the commercial, like there's got to be a better way, but there is
exactly.
A better way.
Exactly. And also I'd like to give a shout out to my favorite product, which is a mini whisk. Have you ever used one of those things?
I have not. No.
It's like it's one of my quote unquote essentials. It's totally unessential, but I'm in love with mine. It's great for like whisking vinaigrettes or getting into the corners of pans. They're awesome little things.
Now let's get into an item that I don't have in my repertoire. You say a digital scale is close to must have in your estimation. I don't really bake. I don't do that kind of precise baking. If I don't bake, do I need a digital scale?
I would say not as much as someone who bakes, but you'd still find it useful.
Okay, but
do you drink coffee?
Well, yes, frequently, early and often.
If you're gonna, you can get serious about coffee and weigh your beans, so you could use it for that. And it's really good for recipes, like you know, if it calls for 6 ounces of rice noodles or things like that, you're often left if you buy a 12-ounce bag, you're like, well, shoot. What is, you know, I need to get 6 ounces out of this. So it's really helpful in that way. But I would say that baking is really the primary reason we say you almost need one of those.
Yeah, I've talked to bakers on Food Friday many times, and they say, yeah, don't measure your flour and stuff by volume. You got to weigh it, right?
Yeah, it's just so much easier and tidier.
We're talking about kitchen gadgets, the good, the bad, and the ugly, with Hannah Crowley, executive editor of Tastings and Testings at America's Test Kitchen. Hannah put together this great list of gadgets and sorted them into must-haves, nice-to-haves, and don't waste your money on. We posted that list at wpr.org/foodfriday. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your go-to kitchen tools, gadgets, and gizmos? Do you have a big drawer of utensils that you never use? Do you have a regret, the thing you bought and just wasted your money on? And do you have kind of an obscure thing that you do use a lot because of something really specific that you cook a lot? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time.
And I happen to love beef jerky. And you know how darn expensive beef jerky is today?
Terrible. Through the roof.
You go out and I bought this yesterday. $2.29 for 1 ounce of beef jerky.
There's nothing in there.
That's about $36 a pound. And with the Ronco Electric Food Dehydrator, you can make your homemade beef jerky for just around $3 a pound.
Another Ideas Network favorite there. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about the best and worst in kitchen gadgetry with Hannah Crowley, executive editor of Tastings and Testings at America's Test Kitchen. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your favorite tool in your kitchen? And have you ever gotten something that proved to be a total bust? You thought you'd use it, you used it once, and then on the shelf it sits. And do you have a utensil or gadget that's been in your family for generations? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go to our callers now. We've got Bill on the line in Deerfield. Bill, hi.
Hey, thank you. So I love America's Test Kitchen. Got a lot of the books. Can't say all the books, but I've got a bunch of the books. And I love the equipment sections on the show. They're really helpful. Saved a lot of money because of that segment. But I have to say that I do a lot of baking, and the digital scale is super important. But just for general cooking, the ThermoPen is an absolute must-have.
Bill, I'm right there with you. I don't know what brand I have, but an instant digital thermometer. I didn't used to do it, so I would just overcook my meat because I was so paranoid. Could you talk about picking out a great instant read thermometer, Hannah?
Yeah, well, I think you have the key right there. It's got to be a digital instant read. There are a lot of dial style, old face ones, and it's a different kind of technology, and it's too slow. You know, your steak can get overcooked while you're waiting for the thing to come up to temperature. Another thing we like is the jackknife style. Like the ThermoPen has the probe folds out, and that gives you this ability to be a little further away from the heat, and that offset angle is a little more comfortable to look at. The ThermoPen really is the Cadillac of instant read thermometers. You know, the new ones, they go to sleep and then they turn on when you pick them back up again. They swivel, the digits rotate, so good for lefties and righties. They've got a light on them if you're a griller.
I like that idea of one you can be further away from, because sometimes I do try to measure the temperature while a thing's on the grill. And in the meantime, my hand is slowly getting up to a well-cooked temperature too. Like, how much distance is that one giving me?
I would say maybe like 10 inches, no,
okay.
8-9 inches or so.
That's still better than the 3 inches that are that my thermometer has. Thanks a lot, Bill, for that call. It's a great idea at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Cara now in Delafield. Cara, hi.
Hi. I was just going to say that my favorite go-to gadget in the kitchen all the time is my garlic mincer, because you just put it in a little gadget and press the two handles, and it keeps your hands really clean and saves the time of having to mince it all up.
Kara, thanks. What do you think? Is that a necessity, Hannah?
I would absolutely agree. Mine actually almost changed my life. That maybe sounds a little dramatic, but there's something about peeling garlic skins and dealing with garlic skins that actually gives me a chill. So it's a weird tick I have. And so when I got a garlic press, and it made my life better, which is, I think, really the gold medal gadget, if it can actually make your life better.
Thank you for that. Now, I'll say I actually like skinning and cutting up garlic, and I used to use garlic presses, maybe I didn't pay enough for them. They kept breaking for me. So, like, heck with it. I'm just going to use my 8-inch kitchen knife, smoosh it, cut it up, and I kind of like, the next day my hands, no matter how much you wash them, still smell like garlic. I'm like, oh, it's a reminder that fun cooking I did yesterday.
Well, that's a nice perfume, I guess.
I'm not trying to impress anybody. Thanks a lot for that call. Let's go to Emily now in Milwaukee. Emily, hi.
Hi. I actually agree about chopping garlic. I think it's very therapeutic, especially with your big kitchen knife. So I have to say, I'm with you on that.
Sweet.
So the gadget, I don't know if it's so much a gadget, but I mean a good Dutch oven, right? Because it's just stove to oven, and you can take it camping. You can do chili and soup and roast and anything you can think of. I have a cast iron, which I just love cast iron. Of course, you got to be good about seasoning it, but I'm all about that. Gotta have it. Can't live without it.
Emily, thanks. Let's talk about cast iron a little bit, whether we're talking Dutch ovens or just pans. Hannah, is it important to have some of those in our collection?
They're great for searing. They do require some maintenance, and they are heavy. So it's really a personal choice. If you are willing to lift them and do that little bit of care, there's a big reward there. And Emily said a great point about Dutch ovens that I didn't say earlier, the stove to oven to grill to campfire capability. That's unbelievable.
Yeah, and I like that with cast iron pans. I just grilled asparagus the other day. It was really thin asparagus, so you couldn't skewer it. I just had it in the cast iron skillet in the grill, and it did a great job. Thanks a lot for that call, Emily. We heard from Peter on Facebook, who just writes, fish turner. And that might be the same thing. You have fish spatula is on your list, and you say it's handy for more than just fish. What's a fish spatula?
Yes. Yes. Okay. So they're kind of, all right, I'm going to be terrible at describing the shape. They're a little more triangular-ish. They're longer and they're tapered, unlike the sort of square shape of a regular spatula. And they have that shape so they can get under a long fish fillet. And they often have a little turn up at the end so they can nudge their nose right under. And we actually use them for everything instead of a normal spatula. If you notice, the handle on a regular spatula is pretty long, which puts you really far away from the thing you're so carefully trying to control. We like fish spatulas because they get you really nice control right up close to the food, and they have that long runway, so things don't flop off. You have a little more of a landing strip there for your food.
Now, a problem I have sometimes with pancakes or other stuff I want to flip is, my spatula doesn't go right under it. I smoosh it up to the edge of the pan until it stops.
Mm-hmm.
Then I can get the spatula under it. Is my fish spatula going to help me not have to do that?
Totally. But a good one. You have to make sure. We actually brought out the calipers when we tested these things.
Wow.
And made sure that our winner had a super thin edge so it could really get under things. Sometimes these things are so thick that you're just like a battering ram going around the pan.
We're talking to Hannah Crowley, executive editor of Tastings and Testings at America's Test Kitchen, getting advice on kitchen tools and gadgets, which ones we want, which ones we need, which ones we can steer clear of. Hannah gave us this great list. It's at WPR.org/Food Friday. She assigns many kitchen tools into those very three categories. Let's go to another caller now. We've got Jim with us in Watertown. Jim, hi.
Hello. Go-to is the plastic flexible dough knife. It's kind of like a half circle, kind of, but it works for getting anything out of any bowl, sticky or not.
Dough knife. Okay. Was that on your list, Hannah?
No. And this is interesting. I don't have any experience with them, but my coworker is obsessed with hers. And I think this brings up a really interesting point that, one person's essential is another person's, they've never heard of it. So I love when people have these things they feel so passionate about. And I think the dough thing can be really good for working the dough around in the bowl and then scooting it all out in one fell swoop. So I've heard they can be really useful.
Thanks a lot for that call. Going out to Mike in Burlington. Mike, hello.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Mike? What gadget?
Our Instapot. Pressure cooker, a fantastic device since they came out. Cooks fast, a lot of flavor in the food, tender.
All right. Mike, thanks a lot for that call. I want to get a countervailing opinion. Stand by, Hannah. We've got Ted in Madison. Ted, hi.
Hi. I was actually calling about the opposite of the Instapot. We had a divided household opinion on that, and I am a classic culinarian and I feel that time is an important factor when developing flavors in food, and I lost out on the decision to not purchase the Instapot, and it was purchased, and I haven't been happy with the flavor profiles of the food that was created in the Instapot.
There's our point counterpoint, Hannah. Instapot, hot or not?
I say hot for the pressure cooking function, not for the slow cooking function. And I wonder with the second caller, I wonder if they're using the slow cooking function or the pressure cooking function, because the cool thing about pressure is it's contained. It just means the pot seals itself super tightly. So none of the steam escaping takes like flavor with it. You can smell it. That's flavor actually going off in the air. So it really keeps everything contained and cooks it right in its own juices. So it can make incredibly flavorful food. But these pots, they also have saute functions. And I would really tell people to use the saute function, because if you're browning your onions beforehand, if you're cooking your garlic a little bit, you're going to develop the flavor a little bit. And then once you put on that top and seal it and cook it under pressure, it can be just beautiful. I actually made mussels in mine last night, which sounds really weird. They only cook for 1 minute under pressure. And, you know, have you ever cooked mussels on the stove and some open and some don't and some open part of the way? The Instant Pot can actually make them all open perfectly.
Wow. All right. Thanks for the Instant Pot calls. Time for one more caller. Fred is with us in La Crosse. Fred, hi.
Hi there. I'm not a complainer by nature, although my wife might disagree. two things I've had trouble with. One was I'm a lefty, so serrated knives drive me crazy. You know, because they've got the serration on the other end. And the other thing is that several years ago, I bought a yellow one and a green one. They were like squeezer handles with that you would go and juice limes and lemons. And I had them for a couple of years before I realized that they both were exactly the same size. one was yellow and one was painted yellow and one was painted green.
Love it, Fred. Thank you so much. So maybe on that knife issue, Hannah, do people make left-handed serrated knives?
They do. They do have them. I tested serrated knives, and I had a bunch of lefties use our winner, and they didn't have a problem with it. They felt like it still drove pretty straight for them. So I wonder, first of all, if maybe it's not the fact that he's a lefty, but that it wasn't a good serrated knife.
Oh,
but,
maybe.
I could be wrong there. We're actually looking into testing more lefty-centric products this year. So maybe I'll have a better answer for him then.
Help is on the way, Fred. And Hannah, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a lot of fun. We'll have to do this again.
I'd love to. Thanks for having me.
That's Hannah Crowley, Executive Editor of Tastings and Testings at America's Test Kitchen. We talked with her about kitchen gadgets and tools from the absolutely must-haves to the don't waste your money on. We've got a bunch of her recommendations posted at WPR.org/Food Friday. You can keep the conversation going on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tell us about your go-to kitchen tools and why they work so well for you. Or tell us about the thing you bought and never, ever used. Governor Evers met with Foxconn Chairman Terry Goh in Milwaukee yesterday. It's the first time the two have met face-to-face. The meeting comes after Evers recently called the company's promise of creating 13,000 jobs in the state unrealistic and said Foxconn was seeking changes to its contract. Goh met with President Trump earlier this week and reportedly said that Foxconn remains committed to its investments in Wisconsin. Ricardo Torres is a reporter with the Journal Times in Racine. Ricardo, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
Well, what did we hear from Governor Evers after this meeting from Terry Goh?
So this was a brief meeting at Mitchell International Airport. It lasted about a half hour at the signature flight terminal, which is where the private jets kind of take off and land. That's where Rob Ferret would go if he had a private jet and he wanted to leave. But
and I don't.
So
yeah.
It happened, unfortunately, right? And so they met there and they got acquainted. Governor Evers called it a good conversation and that this was just the beginning of a relationship. They talked about the transition because Terry Goh is running for president of Taiwan, so he's a bit busy and he is planning to step back from the day-to-day operations of Foxconn. So Evers told us that a lot of their conversation had to do with, you know, what that transition is going to be like. The governor didn't get into specifics about that transition other than to say that things that Goh would normally handle would be handled by other Foxconn colleagues and things. So the governor walked away from the meeting pretty optimistic about the deal. Yeah, like you said, he's been very critical of this deal in the past, and he didn't necessarily walk back his comments, you know, before saying that the 13,000 jobs were unrealistic. But, you know, he kind of is in the camp of he just wants the project to be successful and he wants the taxpayers of Wisconsin to be protected.
Now, Terry Goh also met Racine County officials. Can you tell us who was at that meeting and what came out of that?
So, yeah, so that was at their Opus building in Racine County. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss was there. Racine County Executive Jonathan Delagrave was there. Village President Dave DeGroot for the Village of Mount Pleasant was there. And so what that conversation was like was just, you know, another half hour period. They said that go talk to some of the workers at that building, told them, you know, how appreciative he was of their work. I talked to Jonathan Delagrave yesterday. He said that excuse me, that Go was very appreciative of, you know, the project so far and working with the state and local officials. And Delagrave assured me that, you know, that he asked Go about vertical construction on the Gen 6 facility, and that is still going to happen this summer. It's still on pace to start being built this summer. And then recently there have been a lot of larger news outlets that have been writing about Foxconn, Wall Street Journal, Bloomberg, I believe the New Yorker was down here. And the local officials expressed they wanted Foxconn to be more upfront when it comes to responding to some of these national outlets. And Delagrave said that Foxconn realized that they needed to be more detailed in some of their responses when Bloomberg or Wall Street Journal called them up asking for comment. And so he said that they plan to do more of that in the future.
Right. One reason that some people have expressed skepticism is that Foxconn has changed plans for the type of manufacturing facility it's going to have. There's been talk about changing the kind of jobs that they're going to be creating from more straight up manufacturing to more research R&D, higher paying, but maybe more specific qualifications for it. Do you see that creating confusion for especially those local officials on the ground trying to figure out what the end result is going to be?
Yeah, I've said really the only people that know what's going to happen for sure with this facility are the people at Foxconn. Local officials just, you know, want the jobs to come here. They want the construction to happen in terms of the, you know, the fine details of whether or not there's going to be X amount of jobs in this department versus X amount of jobs in that department. They're not as concerned, but the change has made people here feel a little bit unease about this project. And people have been kind of skeptical of Foxconn, given its track record in other companies, in other countries, excuse me. And so people have been a little bit nervous about this. I mean, this is kind of something that doesn't really happen so much in Wisconsin. We're not very much big into, you know, building skyscrapers or other big things. You know, we kind of move at a slower pace, but it's our pace that we're comfortable with. And this project has been something that the state has never really seen before in terms of a development. And so people have been a little bit uneasy about some of the changes, and local officials just want clarity. That was something that Evers told us about his meeting with Go yesterday, is that he just wants to make sure that the state has clarity on what's going on with this project.
Talking to Ricardo Torres, reporter with the Journal Times in Racine, with the latest on the Foxconn project. After the current Foxconn CEO met with President Trump this week, Governor Evers yesterday, and Assembly Leader Robin Voss and local officials yesterday as well. Ricardo, what do you know about what has been constructed, what is being built, especially in the Mount Pleasant area so far?
So what is being built right now is their Gen 6 facility. They've kind of starting to build the foundation for this huge, I believe it's like 1.3 million square foot facility. That's where they plan to be manufacturing the screen. So right now what's going on in Mount Pleasant is they're trying to make sure that area has the proper infrastructure, that they have the water, the sewer, that they have the road capacity. So some of those things are being put in underground as the topsoil is being cleared off and being prepared for this Gen 6 facility. They've already got one building, at least the exterior, built on the property. And so they will be getting taxed by the Village of Mount Pleasant because they have built on the property. So there's going to be some taxes going back to the village as soon as this year. So that's some of the work that's being done. They have an Opus building that's not too far from the grounds where they're kind of testing their, their manufacturing process to make sure that when the facility, when the manufacturing campus is up and running, that they are up to date with the most effective ways to build out whatever products they plan to build out.
And Ricardo, anybody who drives, walks, or takes a bus in Wisconsin knows that this is construction season for roads. Is the thought that as things warm up in the spring, the weather gets better, we're going to see that construction maybe kick into high gear?
That's what I think people here are hoping. And so we'll see once the weather gets warmer how much construction gets done, whether or not it will be ramped up or not.
And a big question and a concern for critics of the plan is the state's part of the investment, of the tax credits involved, the other supports. What have you heard from Governor Evers and Assembly Speaker Voss after these meetings, specifically about the state's part of the price tag?
Well, if you talk to Robin Voss, he'll tell you that the deal protects the taxpayer. The state's tax credits, the $2.85 billion in tax credits, Foxconn doesn't get those until they meet certain hiring criteria, certain construction and capital investment criteria. So we saw, for example, they didn't meet the hiring threshold for 2018. So they lost out on $9.5 million in tax credits. And Robin Voss is saying, you know, this is the system working. And the governor is just kind of taking a, trust but verify approach with Foxconn. He hasn't indicated, at least to me, that he plans to undo the deal or anything like that, or not pay out tax credits if Foxconn does meet these goals. He's had the DNR look over some of the permits, and so far he said that, the permits, at least on an environmental level, seem okay for the moment. And so he's just keeping more of a watchful eye over what's going on with this project.
As we wrap up, Ricardo, what are you keeping a watchful eye on as we keep watching for construction there?
Well, for sure, seeing how this project continues to develop, seeing the vertical construction going on. I mean, soon we'll be getting word as to what construction companies will be getting the bids to build on this this facility. And we're looking to see, how many people they end up hiring this year and whether or not, the state will end up paying some of the tax credits. And so those are some of the most immediate things that come to mind.
We'll leave it there for now, Ricardo. Thanks a lot for getting us up to speed.
All right. Thanks, Rob.
That's Ricardo Torres, reporter for the Journal Times in Racine. He was with us for a look at the latest on the Foxconn project after Governor Tony Evers met with the company's chairman, Terry Goh, yesterday in Milwaukee. Lawmakers are getting closer to deciding on some of the state's key budget priorities. One of the state's biggest land conservation programs is up for debate, with divisions within the Republican Party and between Governor Evers and environmental groups that have supported him in the past. Some state Republicans are challenging Governor Evers' plan to reauthorize the Knowles-Nelson Stewardship Program for 2 years. They say the program is important for the state's public lands and should be renewed for a full 10 years. Environmental groups agree with them. Today we hear a different perspective within the Republican Party. State Senator Tom Tiffany represents Wisconsin's 12th state Senate district that includes Eagle River, Tomahawk, and Crivitz. Senator Tiffany, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, good afternoon, Rob.
Well, you co-wrote a piece with one of your Senate colleagues recently. You wrote that this program was initially well-intentioned, but that it's become problematic. Why is that?
Because we've accumulated so much debt. We're paying $500,000 a week just in interest on the stewardship bonds. We have $795 million of debt service on the program currently that have to be paid off over the next 20 years. And if we did reauthorization with debt service, we would add another $533 million of indebtedness to the state of Wisconsin. What I've found, Rob, when I've talked to people, most people assume that purchases via the stewardship fund, that are paid with cash by the state, most people don't realize it's done via bonding or on the credit card. And when people find that out, as I talk to them, their support diminishes.
We talked to your colleague last week, Assembly Representative Joel Kitchens. Here's what he had to say about the possibility of the program not being renewed.
I think it would be really bad for Wisconsin in the long term. I think, again, there are lands that need to be preserved. Part of it goes into securing properties along our rivers.
So he worries that he's making the case that, hey, it's worth the price we're paying and borrowing in debt for the benefit we get out of it. What would you say to that point from one of your Assembly colleagues?
Yeah, I just have a different view of it. I think it's important to remember that we can always go out and bond for a piece of land. Let's say one of those once in a lifetime where people say, this is so important to the people of the state of Wisconsin to preserve this piece of land. We can always go back and run a bill and bond for that project if we choose to. Some people are treating this as this is the end of buying any land that could be important to Wisconsinites in general. That's not the case at all. People can introduce a bill at any time to purchase a piece of land.
You also make the case that the program has too much land under its ownership. Why do you see that as a problem?
Boy, we're approaching 20% public land ownership here in Wisconsin and as a whole. And there's a number of counties up by me that are well over 30 and 40%. And it really restricts the ability of those communities to be able to expand their economy. I mean, I was just at the Florence School District this week, and they highlighted this issue, how it affects their school funding when you have so much public land. And so it's time to take a time out on this program.
Yeah, Representative Kitchens had also noted that some local governments love this. Some do have exactly that property tax concern. He thought that maybe just by tweaking things to make sure that this is better negotiated, that this is more inclusive of the needs of, say, a local school district, a local county government, what have you. If you do it that way, this can make it a little more fair. Do you think that we could just do it better?
Yeah, I certainly... So if the program is reauthorized, there's certainly changes that need to be made to it. But I just think there's a broader concern here. As I've seen more of these projects go through the Joint Finance Committee the last couple years, it seems like we're really getting diminishing utility with more and more of these projects. I mean, I think about one that just recently came through in 2019. There was a green space project in Monona, and it was going to be run through the stewardship program. There's going to be some dollars that came via stewardship. And I'm sure it's a wonderful project for the city of Monona. I'm sure it's going to be nice for the community. But why should the people of the state of Wisconsin help pay for that project? And we're seeing many projects like that now, that it's really wants versus needs. And when you look at this bonding that we're doing, I would much rather, if we're going to bond another $30 million a year, let's spend it on roads. Let's spend it on water quality. I mean, Governor Evers has said this is the year of water. Let's do it on water projects that I believe would have a higher and better purpose, would have a much more of a stewardship purchase or purpose, rather than just buying more land, which is really, we're really seeing that diminishing utility with many of these purchases that are being done.
We're talking to State Senator Tom Tiffany from a district including Eagle River, Tomahawk, and Crivitz, talking about the Knowles-Nelson Stewardship Program. Governor Evers' budget plan says renew it 2 years. Some environmental groups and some lawmakers, including one we talked to last week, says no, let's go for the full 10-year renewal, which is the way it's worked in the past. Senator Tiffany says, hold on, we're borrowing too much to pay for it. Senator Tiffany, a case that some people have made for this is, it isn't, this state money gets multiplied. It helps make the Wisconsin eligible either for federal matching grants. Are there some public-private opportunities here? So this is leverage, I guess, to get more money into state conservation.
Yeah, I just think that there's a lot of groups out there that they will continue to fund projects like this, whether the state is involved with it or not. And there may be a few projects that go by the wayside as a result of that. But we really have to look at our fiduciary duty as legislators. Bonding went up significantly from 2003 to 2011. And while we've stopped the increase in the amount of bonding here in Wisconsin, we're still at fairly high levels compared to 15 years ago. It's really time for us to stop this borrowing. Where we can, we need to limit the borrowing that we're doing here in Wisconsin to protect taxpayers in the future.
Now, Governor Evers' budget plan says, okay, 2 years and let's sit down and figure out intentionally what we want to do with this program in the future. So that's not the 10-year renewal that some people are looking for. What do you think of the governor's idea there?
So I was a little bit surprised that the governor did not do renewal, and I give him credit for, in effect, you know, kind of taking a pause here and saying, let's really look at the program. I mean, I'd be interested to see the committee or the task force that he puts together. I'm volunteering now on your show, Rob, to sit on that task force if it happens. I think there really needs to be some serious scrutiny of the program and make sure, and if we're going to continue it, and that may be possible, if we're going to continue to do it, continue to have the program, let's make sure it's for the best purposes for the people of the state of Wisconsin. I can't repeat enough, Rob. I mean, people want us to fix roads. That's what I hear from my constituents. And we hear that from Republicans and Democrats. People want clean water. Well, let's invest. If those are our priorities right now, let's take those dollars and put it in projects like that.
Well, I've got you on the line, Senator Tiffany. You mentioned fixing roads. The governor includes a gas tax increase in his budget plan. Is that the way to pay for the roads?
No. If you look at the Marquette poll from the last two polls that they did prior to the November election, 60% of the people, both times, said, we do not support a gas tax increase. It was upper 50s with this latest Marquette poll that came out. People want us to take that $3 billion that they send primarily from the gas pump each time they fill up. They want those dollars used more effectively on the roads of the state of Wisconsin. Now, I do believe that we do need some more revenue, but it really matters where that revenue comes from. And I don't believe a gas tax increase is the way to go.
Is there a method to get a little more revenue that you are open to in the budget?
You know, I think some of my colleagues are working on that, and I'm anxious to see what they come up with.
And briefly, as we wrap up, getting back to our main point here, the Knowles Nelson Stewardship Program, we've heard now from two different Republicans on with different views on this plan. Do you see a consensus among most of your colleagues of how to go forward on this?
No, there is not a consensus at this point. This issue is being debated, and it will continue to be debated until we get to this section in the budget, which is a few weeks down the road.
Senator Tiffany, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you, Rob.
That's State Senator Tom Tiffany, who represents Wisconsin's 12th State Senate District. That includes Eagle River, Tomahawk, and Crivitz. He was with us today to talk about why he thinks the Knowles Nelson Stewardship Program does not need to be reauthorized for 10 years. Last week, we talked to Representative Joel Kitchens, another Republican who argued the program should get funding for another 10 years. The budget proposal from Governor Evers, a Democrat, only renews it for 2 years and opens up, as you heard, a task force to try to review what to do with it in the future. You can find our interview online with Representative Kitchens at WPR.org/Central Time, and you can let us know what you want to see happen with this Knowles Nelson Stewardship Program. You can email ideas@WPR.org, or you can tweet us. You can always tweet us at Central Time WPR. The word is out. There are new inductees into the World Video Game Hall of Fame, which is a thing. The new inductees, there's four of them. Colossal Cave Adventure. This is a text adventure game. Microsoft Windows Solitaire, Mortal Kombat, and Super Mario Kart. Producer Chris Molina is here with me. What do you think, Chris?
Well, best day of the year, Rob. I mean, some great entries here. You and I talked a little bit prior to this. Super Mario Kart fans, really a big fan of the huge game. I think the series did get a little bit better as time went by. I grew up on the Nintendo 64 version of it, which meant a lot of multiplayer, a lot of shooting people with green shells, and a whole lot of fun. And so the series is still good, but the original, there's something kind of special about that game. And, you know, a lot of the other games on here also really good. I never played the Cave Adventure one. That was a little bit before my time.
So I'll say I never played that exact one, but there were, in the early days of personal computers, there were a lot of these text adventure games going on. And then there were commercial ones like Zork and Enchanter that I played the heck out of. I don't know how they'd hold up now. It takes a lot of imagination and problem solving.
I think we've been spoiled with like great graphics, yeah. 4K, 3D. Going back to a text adventure, I think like would have some benefits. I also think it'd be really hard to pull off.
All right, Mortal Kombat on the list. I played that a little. All right, one nominee that didn't make it. You heard me ranting earlier. Civilization, the game that changed and absorbed much of my life.
I've never played it, and I feel terrible about this.
I've played many versions and spinoffs of it, so maybe... maybe next year.
The one that was left off that I was into was Myst. Maybe next year.
All right. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.